Okay, it's 11 o'clock in Boulder, Colorado, and you're listening to Radio 1190, and this is Climb Talk. I'm Mike Brooks, and in the studio, my co-host, as usual, is Dave McAllister with Pump Factory Road. Dave, who do we have on Climb Talk tonight?
Tonight, Mike, we have legendary climber Christian Griffith.
I thought we weren't going to say legendary anymore.
We shouldn't. That's you. That's on you.
Okay.
But he is legendary. We're keeping the parade alive.
Yeah, I was one of the parade members, wasn't I?
So, Christian, what's it like being a legendary climber in a town like Boulder, Colorado?
Well, that's a good thing about being in a town like Boulder is that, you know, it's just so easy to be a legend.
I think it'd be harder to be a legend.
All you have to do is, like, take your shirt off and walk around on the mall or do something other. Seems a little out of the ordinary, and people consider you special, I guess, you know? I don't know.
Speaking of which, tonight we can talk about a notable quasi-first ascent that you took down tonight. Speaking of doing something special or different, talk about it.
Oh, yeah. I'm developing a new level of free climbing, like all free climbing, I guess you'd almost call it.
Now, where does this...
I call it primal climbing, actually.
Where does this urge come from, Christian?
Urge... I don't know if I would use that word, but no, I have been climbing, virtually every night. It seems like for the past, God, I don't know how many years, maybe like 4 or 5 years, up on Flagstaff. And that's actually where I grew up climbing. And I started when I was probably not quite 12 years old, going up there every day after junior high school. But now I've actually even reduced my range, and I only climb at like one area up there, which is Cloud Shadow. People that boulder on Cloud Shadow around Flagstaff have probably seen me up there innumerable times. But yeah, lately I've just kind of gotten into just kind of going as minimalist as possible, and it's been a very interesting evolution in my climbing. I don't know if it's going to be necessarily a long-term one. Those of the people out there that have seen old issues of climbing have probably seen me. I think there was even a full-page photograph in like Rock and Ice for climbing one time, me in like a thong doing Hagen's Wall. That was maybe 10 years ago. Well, tonight I upped the bar and climbed the Undercling Traverse, both naked and barefoot. So it's like I think probably the first primal ascent of that traverse.
So, Undercling Traverse in Cloud Shadow on Flagstaff Mountain, how hard was that problem?
Well, I think they rated V9.
Mm-hmm. So, how hard is it naked and barefoot?
It depends who's watching.
Ooh!
Oh, okay, well, let's don't go there. And just for so people know, Climb Talk has a new time. Climb Talk runs Friday nights at 10 o'clock on Radio 1190. So again, Climb Talk has a new time at 10 p.m. on Friday nights. So Dave, what questions do we have for our legendary guest, Christian Griffith?
Well, speaking of, you started climbing on Flagstaff, right? And you've been climbing there for a number of years. How do you maintain the stoke to continue going back to do Hagen's? And I understand that you can do it nude or barefoot, but like, how do you maintain the excitement to keep going back to that area?
Well, you know... Like, there was a time when I was very, very young that I had, you know, the early copy of High Over Boulder, you know, which was Cleve McCarty and Pat Ament's guidebook to the basically the climbs in the Flatirons and Boulder Canyon. And there was also a little section in there about bouldering on Flagstaff. And, you know, at that time, Flagstaff for me was, you know, it was my tick list. Like, I'd go through that guidebook and I would... You know, write down the date that I did every single one of those, like one of those boulder problems, you know, even if it was a very easy one, I would write down the date and like some little comment about like what I thought about it. So it was really like my kind of proving ground, and it was how I kind of evolved my own sense of like my skill level and how I, you know, kind of ranked rated to relative to a lot of other people. And then maybe 5 or 10 years later, after I had done most everything, it became kind of one of my training grounds where I would do like a lot of volume and I would do tons and tons of problems in a very quick succession and treat it, you know, back in that time, there wasn't the kind of sophistication in indoor climbing gyms that there is now, so that you really had to rely on, especially in the wintertime when you might only have 30 minutes of daylight, a place where you could get a really concentrated dose of rock climbing in, and then you'd finish up your session going to, like, the door jamb above your, you know, like, mother's kitchen doorway. And that's how you'd finish off your training. So that's what Flagstaff meant to me, like, say, in the early 80s and even into the late 80s. And now, really, as I've grown older and, I guess, matured as a rock climber, it's really very much like a relaxation thing for me. Like, I love going up on Flagstaff and just getting above Boulder. It's awesome being up there, and especially in the evening as the lights start to go out. And, you know, literally, I've done these things like over 1,000 times. I mean, like, I'm talking 1,000 times plus. And I don't really need a whole lot of light to do them. I certainly don't need a pad, and I don't need a spot. And, you know, I guess now I don't need clothes or shoes either. But anyway, you know, it's awesome to be up there and be looking out over the city. And it just kind of lets you put it all, you know, kind of behind you, all the shit that's gone down during the day and all the other stuff that has happened. All right, I'll try and bite my tongue here.
Mike is having a mental breakdown right now. So anyway, in 2006, you climbed the Sit Start Silverback.
Right.
And I remember the quote in the climbing article was they asked asked you how you stay fit, and you said, "Don't let yourself get fat." That was the quote that I recall. So what else is, like, what can a climber do to stay fit? That, I mean, we're all getting older. So how do you stay fit climbing?
Well, I mean, I think that really is, like, one of the most critical things. I mean, I tell everyone that I talk to, like, they ask me those questions. It's like, you know, buy a scale. Like, weigh yourself religiously. You know, I used to live last year across the street from a 93-year-old man who, for 93, it was pretty remarkable. This guy was extremely nimble and quick-witted and physically still really strong. He'd go out there and shovel his walk even if there was 2 feet of snow. And, you know, he staggered down to Pearl Street Mall and get drunk a couple times a week and then stagger back home. And, you know, you'd see him kind of ambling up the middle of Spruce Street and, you know, at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night. And one time I had, you know, just had the opportunity to go into his house because he lives in this beautiful old Victorian on the corner, and I just wanted a tour, so he sort of showed me through. And on the, this guy is actually a pretty famous doctor in town and potentially even delivered me back in the 60s at Boulder Community Hospital.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But to get to the point, in his bathroom, I was looking around this pretty wild old, you know, Victorian bathroom, and the one wall was basically papered with these little strips of graph paper. And I'm like, "Hey, what's all this about?" And there are all these little numbers on there. He's like, "Oh, that's my weight and my blood pressure for the last 25 years. Every single morning this dude wakes up, he takes his blood pressure and takes his weight. And he's like, yeah, blood pressure's looking good. I'm about 2 pounds overweight right now. I guess I'm going to have to cut back on the ice cream." So this is a 93-year-old dude that's doing just fine and has... that's like his one of his disciplines, you know what I mean? And so from a athletic standpoint, I mean, I think especially in a sport, and I've always been convinced that, you know, climbing is fundamentally a strength to weight ratio sport, you know.
Yes.
If you maintain that balance or can improve upon it, you're not only going to maintain your level, but you maybe increase it as you get older. And, you know, to some degree, that's probably even true with me now. I think I climb stronger than I did when I was in my 20s, and part of that's due to the fact that I'm probably leaner, you know, probably a little better trained. And, you know, the other thing too, obviously helps with climbing these days is we do have the potential to really have 4 seasons of rock climbing, you know, historically, especially if you worked or in school, you know, wintertime was a pretty frugal time. You'd go into the field house. I'm sure Mike remembers that. And there was, I haven't been in there for a while, but there was one wall above the stairwell. People would just go back and forth like a typewriter on the flagstone that was sticking out of the wall there. Mm-hmm. And it was always like about 95 degrees. You remember that, Mike? Did you ever climb there?
Oh, I did. And I climbed on the outside of Mackey Pits.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of those places, I don't even know if there's chalk on the walls anymore, or if it's even possible. But that was how we did it. And, you know, then, of course, there was the pull-up bar. And that was pretty much the extent of your winter options as far as rock climbing went. So, you know, now I think it's a lot easier to maintain, provided you don't overdo it and get injured, a good consistency throughout the year. You know, that I guess that could be also conceived as being somewhat detrimental because you don't ever get really an off season.
Do you have any suggestions to people or climbers on how not to overtrain, how to know when you're overtraining? What's the secret to not overtraining?
Well, you know, like, I've always been a big advocate of, like losing weight. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, that's crazy, you'll get weak if you lose weight, and this and that and the other thing. But for me, I've always got stronger. And unlike people that become bulimic or anorexic because they're trying to look better, I think the one thing that's good about doing it or being very conscientious about your diet with rock climbing is you kind of know when you start to get weaker. And I think part of the thing that is true with overtraining is just that feeling of like you're just not, you know, if you plateau and you do something and you get a little better, hey, that's great. But if you start going downhill, it's pretty obvious at which point, you know, you've got to kind of back off. And the other thing is, too, you know, there's really no, like, gold standard because people are all different. Like, one of the things that you discover if you circle the upper echelons is just that one of the things that allows people to be, like, world-class rock climbers, regardless of what generation you're speaking of, is the ability to withstand a lot of punishment and to really train themselves to the bone and not fall apart. You know, there were climbers back in the 80s that were incredibly talented, but, you know, they'd get strong and then they'd pull a tendon, or they'd get strong and they'd get mortally ill for a while, you know, just because their body couldn't handle that kind of stress. And that, as much as just having, like, say, strong fingers or good flexibility or, you know, great coordination, ultimately is one of the variables that is critical to achieving that top level. I mean, look at how much training someone like, you know, Daniel Woods or Carlo Traversi does. And, I mean, it's a huge amount of volume. And that's not something that everyone can do. Mm-hmm.
That was Christian Griffith here on Radio 1190, and you're listening to Climb Talk. Christian, you started the clothing company, Verve. Tell us briefly, why did you start that? How did you start it? What's the genesis of Verve Clothing?
Well, I mean, this is one of those questions I get asked, like, all the time, so I'll try and be, like, kind of brief because I don't want to bore those people that have heard the whole story. But, you know, basically, back in the early 80s, I was, you know, making my living as a professional climber. I had, I don't know, 5 or 6 or maybe even 10 different sponsors. Some were financial, some were just product. You know, it was one of those things that gave me enough money and enough, I guess, of a purpose that I kind of got by and was able to have a reasonably good lifestyle, especially for someone who was in their early 20s. The one thing it didn't, I ultimately discovered, provide me with was a creative outlet. You know, basically I was a hired gun for all those companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered pretty early on, and actually as a result of this, turned down some pretty lucrative contracts simply for the fact that the companies that were interested in having me serve as basically a promotional person for them really weren't interested in anything more than that. They didn't want to know anything about, they didn't want feedback, they didn't want ideas, they definitely didn't want me creating anything for them. And, you know, I guess I've always thought of myself as much as, I don't want to say an artist, but a creative person as much as a climber, and maybe to some degree even more so. And so pretty quickly that became very important to me, that I have actually a creative outlet that allowed me to take my experience and my passion for the sport and turn it into something that I could be proud of. And like I said, with these companies I was working with, that was a dead end. So I met some people that had been working in the outdoor industry in Colorado at that time that had all been laid off because their jobs were basically shipped overseas. And, you know, they were looking for things to do. And I had a couple of ideas for some, like, chalk bag designs and things like that. And initially just asked one of them to make a custom chalk bag for me that I could climb and compete with. And I was so psyched about it. And, you know, ultimately was climbing well enough that people saw this thing I was wearing and acknowledged the fact that it was different and cool, that, you know, they started asking me for them. These other climbers did. And from that, then, in sort of a slow and steady process of accretion, you know, I increased the numbers of chalk bags that I was sort of making available to friends and stores around town and across the country when I'd travel to competitions, and then added other products as either people asked me about them, like, hey, do you make pants? Hey, do you make shorts? Or have you ever thought about making a top or this or that? So, you know, really it was like, you know, taking the cue from my community and then applying my, I guess, creative sense along with, you know, this group of disenfranchised seamstresses here in Boulder that allowed me to kind of spark the company.
And so Verve has grown into, started as a grassroots company, and it still is a grassroots company, and 90% of all of Verve clothing is sewn, at least it was in the past. Now there are two or three seamstresses that work out of their homes, three elderly ladies that you call the grannies. And on your website, you say in many ways they're the one of the best expressions of what Verve is all about. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I guess I've always really been, and they really are grannies. I mean, like, literally, they are grandmas. They have grandchildren, so they're grannies, right? I mean,
that's it.
It sounds a little bit, you know, like something out of Monty Python or something like that. But yeah, they're really nice women, you know. They've been sewing their whole lives. And, you know, at one time they probably worked in factories in places like Broomfield or Longmont or Denver when companies like Low Alpine Systems or, you know, Kelty or Holubar, I don't know, people that know those brands, they had their production here. You know, they're like were a lot of things that were made in this country back even 20 years ago. There was still a ton of stuff being made in the United States. And, you know, they pretty much all lost their jobs. And so, you know, as Verve kind of grew, these people kind of found me, or sort of through word of mouth, through, you know, various friends found me. And, you know, in the case of most of them, there really are only about four or five. I mean, Verve is still a very, very small company. I mean, people come over to the office and they're like, wait a second, so this is Verve? And I'm like, yep. You didn't think I was lying when I said it was run out of a garage. I mean, it still is kind of a garage where we work out of. And, you know, the volume's pretty small, and the product is still very much handmade. And, you know, for example, there's one bra that's pretty famous now. It's called the Lorelei. Like a lot of the really top young women rock climbers wear this top. Every single Lorelei has been sewn by the same woman. There's never been a Lorelei sewn by anyone else in the whole world. And that woman has been sewing for me for probably about 18 years at this point in time.
Wow.
And if you go to her, she sews in a spare bedroom in her house, and it's like the most meticulously kept little, like, room with a great view of the Flatirons and, you know, five machines sitting there, a place where, you know, otherwise like a bed and a dresser would be.
Wow. You talked about job shipping overseas and production shipping overseas and the outdoor industry that's rampant. I mean, so my question is, how do you compete as a domestic manufacturer against these companies that are producing products at much lower cost? Like, that's got to be a struggle, yeah?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you kind of need to, like, almost reframe that whole question, because it's kind of like saying, you know, like, you've seen those pictures of the coral reefs and stuff like that. There are the little fish, you know, that just live in the coral. They don't even stick their heads out, because the big fish are the ones that are swimming around, just scooping up everything that's floating around in the open water. And, yeah, if you want to survive as a little fish, especially in this economy, you do not stick your head out. And you basically get by with, you know, the stuff that kind of finds you. You don't necessarily have an opportunity to go look for it, because so much of what sells product these days is just how big and how much money you can appear to be, how much money you can spend to make your product look like it's the greatest thing in the world, and it's the first time it's ever been done, and it's done in the most environmentally friendly way, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, all those layers are all fabrications in most cases of, you know, companies that just have enormous margins because they have found incredible economies of scale and have done all their production in a way that allows them to sell something for $100 that maybe only cost them $15. You know, it is kind of a tragedy in some ways, because, you know, if you really want to be, I think, a conscious consumer, the kind of the litmus test is if you ever heard of the brand, you probably shouldn't buy it. If you've never heard of the brand, it means that they probably are doing things in a way that doesn't allow them to make, you know, $7 on every $10 purchase that you make. Because they're, one, either using really good materials, two, they're very small scale, and so maybe it's the man who actually, or the woman who owns the business that's, say, doing the cooking or doing the sewing or doing all the design work or whatever. And, you know, they haven't gotten to that point where, yeah, everything's going overseas and they're getting, you know, a $100 jacket made for like $7 or $8. And then with all that extra cash, they can afford to make it appear as though, yeah, it was just made down the street. I think I don't know if I answered your question or not, but...
Well, I mean, it's a complicated question. I mean, I've been in the industry since 98 as well. I mean, you could go large scale. So if REI came to you tomorrow, I think I heard this amazing statistic that Black Diamond does 3/4 of their business with REI. So that tells me, with the scale of Black Diamond, if REI went under, which they won't, Black Diamond would be in jeopardy of going under. But my question for you is, if REI came to you and they gave you a contractual bid for $1 million of goods to sell in their 122 stores, what would be your answer?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously you wouldn't turn that sort of thing down, I guess. I mean, but the caveat would be, like, you know, we're not going to do like what every other company that they deal with works does, and we're not going to take these production jobs overseas. You know, we're not going to give you the super deep discount that you expect from, say, a Black Diamond or a Columbia Sportswear that, again, has these ultra, ultra deep margins. I mean, you know, if, for example, like something that we sell for like $20, I mean, it's costing us like $16 or $17 sometimes to actually make that thing at our cost. So, like, the amount of money that we make to actually, like, you know, pay rent, you know, pay the phone bills, you know, provide the heat, the water, you know, the dog biscuits, et cetera, you know, that's got to come out of that remaining $3. You know, and the differences of going overseas are huge. It's interesting you mentioned REI, though, because about 2 years ago, I actually called up and I was kind of blown away. I had about a 2-hour conversation with the new CEO of REI.
Sally Jewell?
Sally Jewell, yeah. And it was very illuminating to me. You know, her background is in finance. I think she comes from a banking background. And, you know, she's been very, very able in the pursuit of increasing REI's bottom line. But, you know, my take on it is that she is, you know, pretty unscrupulous in terms of her, like, you know, her actual, I don't want to say ethics, but, you know, her appreciation of the global environment. She runs pretty thin. I mean, she doesn't really have, I think, the sort of checks and balances that I guess I would hope someone in her position would have. You know, I brought up the whole notion of, God, you know, REI is, I always thought of as being kind of like the place where the average family could go and outfit their, you know, themselves for some kind of great little mini adventure in the wilderness or backpacking or climbing or whatever. And she's like, yeah, that's right. And I'm like, well, hey, how are those people going to be able to buy anything if they don't have any jobs? And she's like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, everything that you sell in your store is made in China. So how is the average American ever going to be able to afford to buy anything there when you farmed all their jobs overseas? Are you opening stores in China now?
What'd she say, Christian?
Well, Sally basically said that, you know, hey, manufacturing is a done deal in this country, that no one here wants to do it. Kind of like, you know, like Philip Knight said to Michael Moore in that movie that he did, like, hey, no one in America wants to work like that anymore. And that, you know, there's other opportunities for people in this country for jobs. And I'm like, oh, really? Like what? You mean like design work and things like that? She's like, yeah. I'm like, well, hey, you know, if you read the paper, like the Far East now is incredibly skilled at basically knocking off designer clothing and designs before they even hit the markets as originals. So oftentimes the knockoffs are in the shops before the actual, you know, original product is there. And, you know, Sally's counter to that was, well, you know, there are other things. I'm like what? And she's like, well, have you ever tried to find a plumber? And I'm like, are you serious? And she's like, yeah, finding a plumber, it's really hard to find a good plumber. And I was like, okay. Thank you, Sally Jewell. I mean, I guess there probably is a dearth of plumbers in Tukwila and Spokane or in Seattle. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like America can afford to have 250 million plumbers.
That was funny. You're listening to Christian Griffith here on Climb Talk on Radio 1190. What else we got for Christian, Dave?
So I imagine your key values are the same as Verve's key values. And I looked on your website, and I couldn't find the key. Like, it's, I saw the tab for key values, but when I clicked it, it wouldn't come up on my
computer. Our website's pretty antiquated. It's just a skeleton of a website, I'm afraid.
So what are Verve's? I mean, we've talked about them a little bit, manufacturing at home, being a small, tight ship. What other values do you guys
have? Well, I was thinking about this the other day, actually. I don't remember why I sort of started thinking about it. I always get asked, like, oh, you know, I really respect the fact that, you know, you kept Verve small. You know, you could have had a big company for so long, you know, but you decided to keep it small, blah, 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 blah. You know, and I always say, well, you know, no, that's not really right. That's not really true. You know, I didn't want to always have a little company. it is a little company. But I think one of the things I always, and this is, I guess, and you know, kind of a core value, kind of de facto, is that I don't really think I ever needed to make a lot of money. And in some ways, that keeps you small. But that's kind of a core value. It wasn't really about, like, coming out with a great design and then finding a way to make a killing from it. As I said early on, you know, Verve was always like a conduit for like my creativity, and as I became older and less like a cutting edge rock climber from a technical standpoint, it really became my means of communicating with my community. And that I think still is really very much an underpinning of what that brand is all about. You know, I really, really do take the feedback of climbers very, very seriously. And you know, sort of symptomatic of that is one of the big struggles I've had in the last 4 or 5 years is that, you know, Verve is really pretty popular with the yoga crowd. And, you know, I think yoga is okay, but, you know, I don't do yoga.
You don't?
And I mean, I've done it 3 or 4 times, to be honest. And yeah, I mean, I like yogis and, you know, they come in and, you know, I listen to them and get their feedback. And but I feel a little disingenuous, like, pursuing that market. And people's like, oh, you know, you should totally shift your focus. Like, you should really focus on yoga. That's where the big bucks are. That's what Prana's done. That's what blah, blah, blah. That's why they've blown up. And I'm like, God, but it's just not me. You know, it's really not me. If the yogis want to buy Verve because climbing clothing makes sense for yoga, then, hey, all the power to them. That's cool. I'm not going to say they can't buy it. And I'm, in some ways, I've gone and done things specifically that have been more yoga friendly, but it, like I said, that has always been kind of a struggle. And again, that's kind of a core value. I mean, Verve, I want to continue to be as authentic as it can be. Like, I want people to, when they put on Verve, to really feel like, hey, I'm wearing a climbing brand. Another core value, and this goes back to the whole granny thing, is, you know, I really like the idea that things come from a specific place. I think that's something that historically was always the case. You know, when you bought, you know, like a Shetland sweater, it was made in, like, you know, on the coast of England somewhere. You know, if you bought, I don't know, a pair of clogs, you know, they were made from, you know, Denmark or someplace like that. Or you know, you had all these things that were unique to the cultural context that created them, and they were still fundamentally produced there. And so you really were like buying a piece of a culture's history, and not just simply a design. And I just find it kind of, it's almost offensive when I see a lot of, even in European clothing these days, where it says like designed in Sweden, made in China. You know what I mean? It's just, to me, it's just like, they're just lying to you, and they're somehow trying to legitimize the fact that they've sold out one of their core values, which is, hey, they could have actually provided some employment and maintained some cultural identity for their countrymen. But instead, they were sort of chasing the dollars. You know, the accountants looked at them and said, hey, you know, we can make like 3 or 4 times more money and not have to sell a single piece more, but let's just make them over there in China. I mean, shit, man, we'll totally clean up.
Well, here's a question about that. I remember when Osprey Backpacks, such a high-end backpacking company, they make great stuff, high quality. In 2002, I think, they went to Vietnam. And it was a huge deal. I worked at a shop at that time. I was a buyer, and they were our number one seller. But, I mean, how does Osprey compete when they're making a $550 backpack and Gregory's making a $220 backpack, same capacity, same bells and whistles? That's the yin to this yang. You know what I mean? That would be a company's argument who ships their stuff overseas. They're going to go out of business if they don't in this culture. You buy that?
Well, I mean, that goes back to the whole notion of, like, you know, the little fish in the coral, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I mean, ultimately, if Osprey wants, maybe in this culture, in this environment, to, like, swim around with the big fish that are basically, you know, getting whatever they can get, wherever they can get it, then yeah, maybe that is what you have to do.
Right, I gotcha.
And, I mean, because, you know, I don't know that the American consumer will ever wake up to this. I mean, look at what's happened, and I mean, it's pretty crazy, you know, the stats. Here we are in this recession that, you know, I personally don't really believe we've come out of. I mean, I don't know, I think you can spin numbers whatever way you want to, but just the feeling that I have and the sense that I get from people around me is that, you know, there's still like a tremendous amount of, you know, struggle out there, mm-hmm. and kind of recalibration of people's lives going on. And yet, you know, in the wake of all of that, who's booming? Like Target and Walmart. Go into those places and they're filled with imported goods. I mean, mm-hmm. you would think like these people would be, hey, you know, it's less expensive, but I'm not supporting the man down the street that, you know, will lose his job if the sales don't pick up in his little, you know, manufacturing place, or, you know, in that, this and that. You know, I mean, one of the things, it's funny, I just started getting involved in Facebook for the first time just because I kind of had to, because everyone was like, hey, I tried friending Verve Climbing, but you guys haven't gotten back to me for like 6 months. What's up? You know, like people all hurt. And I'm like, well, that's because that account was set up, but no one's looked at it for the last 6 months. So I started kind of getting on there and, you know, trying to be a little bit more proactive, even though I have a real struggle with the computer. And anyway, one of the things that I like said is that, you know, just recently on my little page, I think it's pretty true, is that, you know, everyone talks about value and, you know, quality, you know, Chinese quality isn't as good, or, you know, foreign quality isn't as good. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. I mean, certainly, like, based on what, you know, you were talking about, like, here you got the same pack, $200, here the other pack, $500. You know, one's made in Vietnam, one's made in the U.S., one's twice as expensive. So the quality may be the same, and the value in terms of just pure cash for what you have in your hands is far greater buying the Vietnamese pack or the Chinese pack or whatever. But if you start to actually appreciate value in the context of what it means from a social and an environmental and a moral standpoint, you know, obviously you're talking about a lot more than you're buying a lot more than what you have in your hands. You know, when you buy something that's, say, made in a democratic country, hopefully you're contributing to the future success of the concept of democracy as a good political system. When you buy something that's made in an authoritarian regime, you know, just like if you were buying, I don't know, you know, something from, say, China, which is a highly oppressive society from everything I can gather, you're basically saying, hey, this is the new paradigm. This is what we want. So when some developing nation looks around to see, oh, what's the model that we want to take in terms of growing our country and becoming more of a world player, are they going to look at America with its gluttonous banking industry and its collapsed, you know, infight-filled democracy, or are we going to look at China with this, you know, double-digit growth every year? It's pretty obvious. And so if we as American consumers continue just to look at value from a standpoint of, like, oh, here's $10, how much can I get? How much can I carry out to my SUV at the end of the shopping spree? Ultimately, we're going to lose. And maybe not lose this generation, but, you know, if you have children, you really ought to be thinking about that.
Cheerio.
That's an interesting answer, Christian.
Value. It reminds me of the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. If you've read that, it's a philosophical study on value. And it's exactly what we're talking about. Gumption and value. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, that's an interesting aside there, Dave. And so I noticed you have 5 or 6 or 10 questions we want to ask Christian.
Yeah.
And we are running a little bit late. So what other questions do you have for Christian Griffith?
Okay, so we talked about key values. On your website, you have a great quote. There is nothing sustainable about something disposable. And that's, I mean, obviously makes sense, and you don't need to intuit anything about that, but how does that fundamentally affect Verve as a company?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's one of the things you see with the evolution of, like, you know, what you want to say, like, organic and, you know, a lot of the green stuff that's going on out there, is that to some degree I think people are using it, the notion of green, as an excuse to, like, to make things more disposable, to cheapen them, because, hey, it's kind of okay if it falls apart, because, you know, it didn't really hurt the earth to make it. Well, I mean, obviously that's just not the case. You know, that even recycling, for example, I mean, you know, to take a bunch of plastic bottles and grind them up and melt them down and then recast them and then squirt them out and fill them up with whatever it is again and go through that whole process is tremendously costly from an energy standpoint. You know, I think that the notion that, you know, something should be made to last as long as it possibly can. You know, I had, like, this is one of the things, again, like, I want to bring up Facebook again. I mean, maybe I'm newly enamored, but it was really cool. Today someone posted a photo on my page of this 8-year-old pair of Kaji shorts that he said he was going to frame because he had done so much incredible climbing and had so many great adventures in these shorts. And they were just, like, there were probably like 6 or 7 patches just on the back of these things. And, you know, they were in tatters, and he kind of held them up for the camera and took this picture. And, you know, said, I love these shorts. You know, I don't think I can wear them anymore because people are giving me too hard of a time. But, you know, here's someone that had, like, you know, we'd made something that was worthy of this guy's, like, really loving it to death. And to me, that's, like, that's really an ultimate compliment, you know? And probably also, like, a paradigm that I would like to see, you know, people carry forward, even if what they're doing isn't necessarily 100% green, per se. You know what I mean? Like, if something is made from conventional cotton but lasts 10 times as long as an organic cotton version, then, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer, which is ultimately better, which is more sustainable. I may have even said this before in an earlier interview, but I remember a long time ago, maybe it wasn't that long ago, being asked what I thought of Patagonia's whole push for, you know, organic cotton t-shirts, and whether or not I thought it was really a great environmental thing. And, you know, obviously it's really valuable that Patagonia has pushed organic out, and as far as cotton goes, out into the forefront as it had. But at the time, my response was, wow, well, if you're really interested in, like, being environmental, why don't they just publish an ad that says, you know, hey, you know, rather than say, hey, come buy our new organic t-shirt, you know, this uses less and less water, or this and this less chemicals to produce, and does this and that and the other thing. Why don't they just run an ad that says, hey, this year, you know, help save the world. Don't buy any new t-shirts. Just wear the 10 or 15 that you've already got in your drawer. You know? Because that is really, I think, a phenomena that a lot of people forget about. Is that, you know, chances are you've already got something that will suffice. You don't really need to go buy a new one.
Stockholders wouldn't like that move, though.
Well, that's one of the things I love about climbing barefoot these days. As I told Mike before we came in here, I go, hey, the really great thing in this economy about climbing barefoot is every night you get a fresh resole.
You're listening to Christian Grip on Climb Talk on Radio 1190. It's now 1142 in Boulder, Colorado, and we're starting to run out of time, Dave, but a couple more questions for our guest, Christian, tonight.
Sure. Let's switch it over to Verve athletes. It's kind of a two-part question. So Verve has hosted athletes like Chris Sharma, Tommy Caldwell, and Katie Brown. And after a time with Verve, they left and moved on to different companies. And now you have Carla Traversi, Emily Harrington's, John Glassberg?
Emily Harrington's with, like, North Face, I think.
Oh, she is? I thought you still had her. Well, Carla Traversi's on your team. Is John Glassberg still on
Glassberg
your team?
Glassberg is, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, what kind of effects do sponsored athletes' departures from and arrivals to have on a company like Verve?
I've never had the money to really to use or exploit to the fullest extent some of the talent that I've had. And, you know, it is pretty amazing the caliber of climbers that I've had, I guess, sponsored throughout the years. I mean, from, like, top World Cup rock climbers to, you know, up-and-coming stars like Chris Sharma. I think Verve was probably Chris Sharma's first sponsor, and probably Tommy Caldwell's as well. And that was just because, you know, I was competing in a national, and there was this, like, 13-year-old kid who, he didn't make it through the semifinals, but, like, I just remember watching Sharma on this roof, hanging on to these two little, like, I don't know, I mean, maybe he was little then, like, maybe they were jugs, I can't tell, but, you know, for him, maybe they were jugs, but I was just like, oh my God, this kid has got so much fight. It was unbelievable watching him up there, and, you know, he was tiny. And he was just outclassed, you know, in terms of just pure effort, everyone else, including the people that ultimately went on to win the comp. And I just, like, you know, it's one of the things I always really kind of loved supporting and encouraging was, like, you know, young climbers that really showed that was, like, going to be their, you know, kind of the love of their life, you know, rock climbing. And you know, I remember approaching Sharma then because his home gym was the Pacific Edge, and Diane Russell was an old friend of mine from back in competing in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s. And that's kind of how that connection was made. But, you know, I guess I get, like, a huge amount of it kind of reinforces in my mind that I'm doing the right thing when I get someone, say, of the caliber of like Carla Traversi or even, you know, Alex Puccio, until, you know, recently she signed up with Prana, that's willing to, like, you know, wear my stuff for free, basically. I mean, we've never paid anyone, never been able to afford to pay anyone to wear our clothes. And so, you know, it really comes down to, wow, I'm still doing things right when I continue to get people that are essentially turning down relatively lucrative contracts or are risking relatively lucrative contracts to where we make.
Nice. How do you choose your athletes?
Back in the day, I used to travel and climb a lot around the country and around the world, and it was easier to connect that way, just because I would see people firsthand. And, you know, I mean, I used to be a World Cup course setter, so I would go to, like, all the nationals and set a couple of World Cups, and, you know, I'd see these people firsthand, and, like, okay, that person's really impressive, that person's probably just, like, you know, really good looking, and that's why you've seen so many pictures of them. And, you know, you kind of separate the wheat from the chaff pretty directly that way. You know, now I think I rely a little bit more on, you know, things that other climbers say that I respect, and, you know, also ultimately too, you know, just kind of how they come across. You know, there's people that come across, you know, I get every now and then people asking for sponsorship, and, you know, their list of sponsors is twice as long as their list of impressive ascents. And those people I normally don't really give much thought to. But then there are other people out there that are very modest but have extremely impressive tick lists, and yet no one's given them anything. And that's like, wow, this person is just doing it for all the right reasons. And, you know, they're kind of this unsung hero. This is a great person to have on board because they're going to continue to pursue the sport regardless of whether or not they're making a lot of money. And the chances are they're going to stick with my brand as a primary sponsor, even if someone drops a big check in their lap, because that's not why they're doing it.
And I could be wrong, but I think it was Carlo maybe 2 years ago who wrote this little manifesto online about sponsored athletes, meaning you can be a really strong athlete who doesn't care about the community, or you can be B, not a very strong climber, but someone who really cares about the community, or you can be C, a really strong climber who also cares about the community. And he said, like, his goal was to be a C-sponsored athlete. I think he picked a good one. And I've met him, and I've seen him a number of times at the Crag, and he's been nothing but gracious.
Yeah, I know. He's a really forthright, really, you know, super talented person, super driven person. Definitely has, I think, a lot of potential as a climber going forward. And I think really appreciates, you know, what both the companies that he's working for, as well as his circle of friends, sort of do to support his rock climbing. And that's also obviously a really important thing to have in the people that you support as a business, you know.
Can I ask one more question?
Okay.
We got time for
one more question.
I wanted to get to this one. There have been some rumblings on the internet recently from on Jamie Emerson's site, Brian Reynolds' site, Climbing Narc, Alex Johnson's personal blog, about the issue of especially skimpy women's clothing in the comp scene, and the idea that maybe some of the girls are getting extra attention, undue attention for their physical attributes rather than their climbing skills. Peter Beal has also talked about this on his website. You have any comments on that issue? You can say no, that's all right. But
well,
as a clothing manufacturer, I thought I'd put you on the spot.
I mean, I love designing women's clothing. It's like one of my favorite things to do because, you know, women far more than men for the most part appreciate, you know, the efforts you go to make things look good.
It's true.
I think women ultimately, I don't know. I mean, I ultimately think that that's kind of like, it sounds to me like a kind of like some sort of sexist reaction. You know what I mean? Like, we live in a society that still is very, and always will be, very kind of, sex sells things. Sex gives people, sex appeal gives people attention. That's just a fundamental thing. I don't believe that climbing clothing will ever devolve to like burkas or something like that, where all of a sudden like modesty becomes one of the critical components of being, you know, a truly great climber. You know, hey, I'm climbing naked up there by myself on Flagstaff. I'm not trying to turn anyone on. It actually just is really a great feeling not to have anything rubbing your body when you're moving on the rock. It's pretty, in and of itself, it's pretty remarkable. And I have always been a major proponent personally of like less is more when it comes to clothing. Like, you know, I pretty much stripped down to next to nothing when I was doing my hard red points and stuff like that, because I didn't want to be encumbered. I didn't want things getting caught on the rock. I didn't want to have like one of my classic old stories when I was bouldering as like a young teenager on Flagstaff. First time, it was actually almost the first time that I did Pride's Mall, which, you know, at age 13 was a pretty big deal. We're talking about like, I don't know, it's probably only V3 or something like that. But, you know, it's a full-blown mantle the way I did it. And I remember like pushing out the mantle. And for the first time, I'd kind of gotten to the point where I started to push up. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to do it. When all of a sudden, my thumb got caught in the breast pocket of my Great Pacific Ironworks t-shirt. And all of a sudden, I came to the screeching stop with my thumb stuck in the pocket. And I sat there struggling with it and tried to, and ended up tearing a little bit, and then I just ran out of juice and fell off. So I had to take the shirt off at that point in time to send the problem the next go. And, you know, I guess that was always one of those things. People used to like, why don't you put pockets in Verv clothing? And, you know, from back in the day, maybe that was like left a bad taste in my mouth or something. But, you know, to the same degree. I mean, ultimately, if, you know, people also talk about, hey, you know, climbing becoming more of a popular spectator sport, you know, we want to be, climbers want to make all this money, climbers want to do blah, 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 blah. You know, one of the things that's going to do that is people not wearing like baggy surfer jams and like, you know, ill-fitting t-shirts. I mean, climbers have got gorgeous bodies. Like, climbing is a sport that really trains your entire physique. It doesn't just create like one kind of grotesque, disproportionately large set of muscles. You know, particularly women, I think, are amazing. I remember my ex-wife was a Pilates instructor, and these, you know, middle-aged, you know, women would ask her, oh my God, you know, is Pilates going to do this for me? And she used to just say, actually, it's all from rock climbing, you know? And that's one of the things I think that's great about the sport, and certainly one of the things from a design standpoint, I feel pretty blessed to have a population that is in some ways so physically honed.
You've been listening to Christian Griffith. Christian owns and operates Verv Clothing here in Boulder, Colorado. Christian also did the first ascent of local test pieces like Destashado, Paris Girl, Verv up in Boulder Canyon. And Christian, thank you for joining us on Climb Talk tonight.
Yeah, thanks man. Fun.
Appreciate it.
Dave, can you talk us out while I set up overnight ambient?
Thanks for listening, everybody. You've been listening to Climb Talk on Radio 1190. We will see you, remember, at 10 o'clock in 2 weeks on Friday. Talk to you then.